Previously on Beta.
Hi. So you can probably tell from where you're sitting that I am about 6 months clean and sober.
Surrender, Dorothy.
Dorothy? Who's Dorothy?
Can't no one compel another man to engage in recreation. Certainly not a son of a gun as ill-humored as yourself.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta. Today, author Brian J. Cramp on one of the greatest, if not the greatest band to come out of the Midwest, Rockford, Illinois' Cheap Trick.
They were more of a Madison or a Milwaukee band than a Chicago band. You know, that's where their following was. That's where they played a lot more than they ever really played in Chicago at the time.
And Milwaukee biographer and film scholar Patrick McGilligan on how legendary comedy director Mel Brooks broke new ground and wind with his hilarious take on the Western, Blazing Saddles.
Mel gives interviews nowadays where he says, you know, we couldn't make that kind of film nowadays because it's politically incorrect. I'm not sure, because it's so well done, it got away with it.
But first,
And before I launch into this bit, I just want to tell you I'm uncomfortable talking about sex on stage, because I have this theory that female comedians of my generation, when we were coming up in comedy in the early aughts, we were encouraged to talk about our sex lives on stage because it was like the only way we could get men in the audience to listen. So as I got older, I was like, that. I'm not going to talk about sex on stage. I'm going to talk about politics instead. And long story short, that's why nobody knows me.
That's a clip from comedian Jenna Friedman's Peacock comedy special, Lady Killer. The special delivers definitive proof that Jenna is one of the bravest and most provocative comedians working these days. And she is not trying to make you feel comfortable. She's actually trying to make you feel uncomfortable. Why? Because she wants to talk about what's on her mind. And if it just so happens to be on the dark side, that's understandable, because these are dark times, in her opinion. Just a quick warning. Jenna and I tackle controversial issues like abortion and violence in America. She joined us from her LA home to talk about Lady Killer, which she describes as an hour of dark feminist stand-up comedy.
Yeah, it is pretty dark. I think it also, just being pregnant, People have a very different reaction to you when you're on stage pregnant. And and my comedy's always been pretty morbid, but to be pregnant while you're doing it, that disconnect, I think, is a lot for people, but it was so much fun to actually perform.
Yeah, and so much fun to watch. You sold your special before you became pregnant.
Yes.
And before Roe versus Wade was overturned. How did those two events change the way you wrote jokes?
Well, typically, comedians, before we tape specials, we will be working out jokes for at least 6 months or longer. Sometimes people will be touring a show for a couple years before they tape, do like 100 or more shows before they tape. Because I was pregnant during a pandemic, I wasn't really performing indoors at the clubs, and I was writing jokes on the fly a lot more than I would have liked to.
I should have opened with Roe. Which is a great baby name for the one you're going to be forced to have. Pretty soon, all the kids, and there will be so many of them, won't even know what the word abortion means. You'll have your son tugging on your maternity boyfriend jeans, being like, "Mommy, mommy, what's up abortion?" And you'll have to be like, "Well, little Wade."
There are definitely timely jokes in there. Are they all as polished as I would have liked them to be? Maybe not. But that was just a function of trying to write material as the news was changing and as I was physically changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very challenging. That makes your achievement of turning out, creating such a great special, all the more impressive. Abortion isn't a laughing matter for a lot of people, but you've addressed it a lot before with your work on The Daily Show and your 2016 special. Why is this subject important to you?
Abortion isn't a laughing matter, but what's going on now is so scary and horrifying. And I think, everything I do think is a laughing matter, to be honest. I think you can make jokes about everything.
I know abortion is a sensitive topic, and if anything I say makes you uncomfortable, feel free to leave. I would never dare force you to do anything against your will.
I understand that, you know, people have sensitivities across the board, but the fact that we're not talking about it, we're letting people who really have no grasp of science or medicine or women's health dominate the conversation. And because they're dominating it, they're able to pass policies that are actually killing people. The fact that if you have an ectopic pregnancy, which is will never be viable, and you can't get it removed in certain states, is atrocious. There are so many things going on right now that I think because everyone is so afraid to talk about them, we've let people who don't have the best intentions dictate policy, and we're in a really, really dangerous position. So I think not only is it a moot point whether or not abortion's funny, I think we have to just talk about it and take back the narrative because people's lives, women's lives are on the line.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right about that. You come across as very fearless on stage, and you're not afraid if the joke doesn't land. And in fact, it seems to me at times that you kind of actually like it because you get to provide your own laugh track. Your comedy has been described as confrontational. Is that how you see it?
No, I don't know. I always joke about what I find interesting or funny or absurd or what makes me angry. I'm not doing it to shock people, but I will say that there's one specific joke in the show that is a joke about miscarriage, and miscarriage is a sensitive issue, but as I've gotten older, a lot of my friends have gone through it, and people, I think because there's such a stigma around it, when it happens to you, you feel even more alone because you don't realize how common it is.
You guys are so scared. What you need to realize is that everybody miscarries. That is a children's book that hasn't been written yet. Everybody miscarries. We just don't talk about it because you guys react like this. But while we're not talking about it, they are legislating it. They're criminalizing it. In Indiana, there is a law where they want women who miscarry to have to bury the goop. Yes, yes. And there's no word for the byproducts of conception, so let's just call it Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand.
And I did that joke before I was pregnant, and it definitely got groans, but people laughed. But then doing that joke being visibly pregnant, the audience was so much more uncomfortable. And I think because I knew the joke worked when I wasn't pregnant, it gave me the confidence to tease and bait the audience. Because I knew that reaction was really just because they were looking at me and judging me for being pregnant, as opposed to actually taking in the joke and enjoying the joke.
So if your comedy isn't confrontational, how would you describe it?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it could be confrontational. I guess I'm not trying to make people feel comfortable. I think there's so much
other time.
Watch the Great British Bake Off for that. You know, like I'm not.
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't think about how other people. I guess one of the downsides to, you know, what I do, or maybe why I'm not like a household name by any stretch of the imagination, is because I'm not like thinking like what's going to make the audience feel good, which I think a lot of comedians do and a lot of people do in entertainment. And I think I kind of come more from a place of like, what do I want to say? And it's taken a lot longer for that to resonate with people, but when it does, it's even more rewarding.
We have to laugh, otherwise we would just cry. There's a lot to cry about, and I just want you all to know, for the record, I love men. I love men. One of my best friends is a man. I love men. I'm half man on my dad's side. Just got it checked.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if people thought of it as confrontational, that's cool.
You're not a household name yet, but I think that
nobody has homes anymore. There's a housing crisis. So I don't, who needs to be a household name anymore?
Right, exactly. You're right, but it's important what you're doing. That it appeals to you, and it's as you said, it's not the kind of material content a lot of other comedians do, and maybe audiences don't care for because it's too kind of, you know, heady and thought provoking. But I think that's all the more important that and all the more valuable that you are doing that.
I'll take it. Yeah. I mean, I did a show in Wisconsin. I think someone at the Stoughton Opera House, it was a really fun show. And I think people came, a lot of people came, I think, because they listened to your show. And it was cool. It's more fun, provided that everyone's civil. It's more fun for me to perform for people who don't know my comedy or know what I'm doing. It's always tickled me a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. One of the other subjects that you talk about, well, you talk about several subjects, but another one is about how America hates moms. Why does America hate moms?
I think, as I said in the special, you can just look at our policies that we have in place. We don't live in a country where it's easy for people who have children, particularly mothers, to thrive.
You can tell by our laws. We are the only developed nation without paid leave. The best way to get the government to pay for your time off as a new mom is to become a cop and shoot someone.
We make it so hard for women in the workforce. Working mom, I said this in my first special, it's like chai tea, two words that mean the same thing as if being a mom isn't work. We have this idea of like American independence and this idea that you can make it on your own without help. And anybody who's a mother, particularly a new mother, needs help. And we don't allow for that.
Very well said. You've said about your true crime series, Indefensible, that you try to make light out of the darkness. How challenging was it for you to make light out of the darkness for Lady Killer?
I mean, the stand-up special, I think we pulled off the best version of what that show could have been given the parameters we were dealing with. You know, it is dark. From I co-directed it with Shannon Hartman, and that was the intent was to have it visually kind of look dark, and you're focused on the performer on stage, and even down to what I was wearing, I wanted to blend in with the curtain behind me so that the pregnancy kind of fades into the background, and you just see this person on stage talking. You don't see my pregnant body. We are also in really dark times, so I don't think the special is particularly darker than what people are experiencing, or just, you know, people in our country with everything going on, having nothing to do with women's health, everything else. I think the pandemic, the economy, people are kind of in a dark place, a lot of people.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is indeed the case. Now that Trevor Noah is leaving The Daily Show, there's speculation about who should replace him. I'm thinking it should be you, Jenna Friedman. Are you interested?
Of course I'm interested. It's never going to happen. And I appreciate you saying that. I've gotten some texts from friends and I've seen some blogs pitching me, and I would do it in a heartbeat, but it's never, there's just no way. I'm not up.
Why? Why is there no way?
Well, I think in my most cynical... The most cynical side of me, just how these decisions get made. Like I just don't think I'm in the running. I think that there are a lot of things beyond just people's comedic voices that put them in the running for a job like that. And I don't think it's going to happen. That said, if it did happen, I would welcome it. It would be incredibly thrilling. I would do it yesterday. I would love that job. I've worked at The Daily Show.
Love that as a field producer.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So let's pretend that you're wrong, that you're sure. Wrong, and it is going to happen. Uh-huh. What would be your vision for The Daily Show with Jenna Friedman?
I mean, you can't top Jon Stewart. Trevor did an excellent job. He had the biggest shoes to fill, and he did a great job. I think it's never going to happen, but I will say one thing about Jon. So Jon announced his retirement from the show, and while he was doing that, I was working with Jordan Klepper on a field piece in Florida. And it was a piece about guns, how in the state of Florida, they actually have they had a gag order at the time. It's probably still in effect, where physicians couldn't legally warn parents about gun safety. It's totally bizarre, but that was what our piece was about. And we were talking to a Second Amendment attorney who was a kind of wackadoo, and the news came out that John was leaving the show, and we all found out at the same time. And this attorney, who had polar opposite political views from John, was still sad to see him go. And to me, that just sounded like such a triumph, that someone who doesn't agree with you could still appreciate you and watch you. And I think that, I don't know if it's possible for anyone else to fill those kinds of shoes, but to me, that would be the goal of like the next host of that show, just to kind of bring people back. We're so polarized right now. It'd be cool to be able to, I don't even know if it could ever be a woman, to be honest, but whoever it is, it would be cool to see, because I do think that that's something that we need desperately right now as a country.
Yeah. If you don't mind my asking, did you get any of that kind of positive feedback from people who have watched Lady Killer, people that maybe didn't agree with you but said, you know, similar things to what that gentleman said to John?
I haven't gotten a ton of feedback on it. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, but there hasn't been anyone who disagrees with me politically who's like, this is a good show. Not yet, no.
Yeah. Jenna Friedman, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Lady Killer, and congratulations in advance on The Daily Show with Jenna Friedman.
I think
it might happen, seriously.
Thank you.
Comedian Jenna Friedman joined us to talk about her Peacock stand-up comedy special, Lady Killer. Find out more about Jenna and her special at wpr.org/beta.
There really isn't another band that quite straddled as many of the subgenres as Cheap Trick did. And also, they were funny and kind of satirical, self-deprecating.
Coming up, author Brian J. Cramp joins us to talk about how Cheap Trick is still rocking and rolling almost 50 years after they began. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Brian J. Cramp is from Waukesha. He was raised right across the street from the Sunset Bowl bowling alley. This is where veteran record producer Jack Douglas discovered the Rockford, Illinois band Cheap Trick. So it's only fitting that Brian is now the author of a hefty book about Cheap Trick's early years. Yeah, he could have written a book about the early years of the Sunset Bowl, but that wouldn't have been nearly as interesting. Cheap Trick has been around for almost a half century, but their music still sounds as fresh and vital as ever, according to Brian. His book, This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick, makes a very strong case for why Cheap Trick might be one of the best rock bands ever. Beta's resident musicologist, Steve Gotcher, asked Brian how he came up with that title.
So on the inner sleeve of their first album, there's basically a fake biography written by Eric Van Lusbader, who ended up becoming a pretty famous writer. He took over the Jason Bourne series when Robert Ludlum passed away, and he worked for Epic at the time, and he wrote this basically kind of a farcical biography of the band, and that's the first line, the first sentence of that, printed on one entire side of the inner sleeve of the first album is that biography.
Yeah, because obviously your book demonstrates that this band has quite a past.
Yeah, I really like that title for different reasons, but the idea that it's, you know, kind of humorous because, yeah, the entire book is about their past.
Your book ends its history after the release of the third record. Why did you decide to stop there?
The plan was to end it right before Budokan was about to come out and break big in the United States. Kind of the big cliffhanger. And then basically everybody knows what happens after that.
Early on, Rick Nielsen and Tom Peterson were part of a band called the Grim Reapers, and then they later became Fuse. What was that band like?
Well, that was Rick's first band. His very first band was called the Phaetons, but that was short-lived, and that's what turned into the Grim Reapers. The band existed for a couple of years before Tom Peterson actually joined, and they were exclusively a cover band. And eventually they had two different singers, and they would play a mix of kind of rock and roll and soul music. And they were high schoolers. But when Tom Peterson joins, Tom had a band called Toast and Jam with Craig Myers and Chip Greenman. And those three guys were like amazing musicians, and they played really well together. And when Rick Nielsen saw that band, he had already been thinking about converting the Grim Reapers to a band that played originals, because that was really kind of the way to go if you wanted to make a career of it. And so when he saw Toast and Jam, he decided he wanted those guys for his band. And really, basically, Rick joined Toast and Jam, but then they used the Grim Reapers name just because it had more, they could get better bookings and it had more notoriety. So there's really two completely different bands that were called the Grim Reapers. And the one with Tom Peterson was really Rick joining Toast and Jam and then changing the name. And then that of course, is the band that became Fuse.
Did Rick and Tom's experience in that band contribute in any way to what Cheap Trick would become?
I don't think so, beyond just, you know, they had so much experience playing shows night after night, even before they were in Cheap Trick. So by the time all those guys came together as Cheap Trick, they were already such seasoned musicians and experienced performers. But if you listen to the Fuse album, there's really not even a hint of what was to come with Cheap Trick. I mean, they were all teenagers when they recorded that record. And I think it took Rick Nielsen a while to figure out his songwriting style. And a lot of the bands that would influence what Cheap Trick became didn't even exist when he was his first foray into writing original songs with the Grim Reapers and Fuse.
What is it about Cheap Trick that checks so many boxes for rock music fans?
You know, they were punk before punk. They were metal before metal. They were in 74, 75, 76, they were writing and performing these songs that at the time were really adventurous and crazy and experimental and unique. And they incorporated so many different influences. So I'm a huge record collector and rock fan, and the music I love, which is like hard rock, heavy metal, punk rock, power pop, glam rock, Cheap Trick was kind of all of that. And there really isn't another band that quite straddled as many of the subgenres as Cheap Trick did. And also, they were funny and kind of satirical, self-deprecating, all these different elements that you could really appreciate on so many different levels. Cheap Trick were never even close to pretentious. Cheap Trick could appeal to everybody from Stiff Records to Trouser Press. All these kind of guys loved them, but then they could go on tour with Kiss and all the Kiss fans would love them. There weren't really many bands that could pull that off, that could appeal to the kind of the elite and kind of the underground, almost alternative scene, like Stiff wanted to put out their first album, or Bomp Records, an indie label in California, loved them. But then at the same time, they were out on tour with Kansas.
Yeah, they really didn't seem like a band that took themselves too seriously. I mean, I'm thinking of the song Hello There, where they have two lines in the song, and then they come in with these rock power chords that make the song such a great rock and roll song, but so simple.
Yeah, and when you look like Cheap Trick looked, there's always that kind of element of almost satire that helps get that kind of thing across to where it doesn't seem ridiculous.
Now, you mentioned that they had a lot of influences, but I'm wondering if there are any particular bands that influenced them the most.
Well, obviously, The Move and Roy Wood always get referenced, but that's the thing. They have so many different styles incorporated that they sound like so many different bands from song to song. But, you know, if you listen to a band like Sensational Alex Harvey Band, you will really hear the Cheap Trick influence. But then you listen to Sparks and you really hear it there as well. And these were oddball bands, and these were bands that were far better known in Europe than over here. This was the kind of stuff that Rick Nielsen really picked up on and appreciated and, you know, incorporated some of these kind of eccentricities into his own songwriting. But he really had his own unique kind of style that he developed.
Some people only know Cheap Trick from their hits and think of them as kind of like one-hit wonders. Now, if you had a chance to pick a record that demonstrates the band's depth and would change someone's mind, what would it be?
Well, the first album is a brilliant piece of work. It's a wonderful document of that early club band, because Jack Douglas seemed to pick all of their weirdest, most abrasive songs for the most part. I mean, they had I Want You to Want Me and Surrender ready to go for the first album, but Jack Douglas took it in a completely different direction, but ended up kind of giving us a time capsule of what it was like to see Cheap Trick in the clubs. But the first record is very different from what was going to come later. So, you know, an album like Heaven Tonight is more of a, I think, a representation of both sides of Cheap Trick, with the more melodic pop material and some of the heavy abrasive stuff like Auf Wiedersehen, which is a song that another song they had for the first album that would have fit really well on the first album. Wiedersehen is a great example of Cheap Trick's kind of crazy, abrasive material. But then I think a song like On Top of the World is maybe the best example of just how great a songwriter Rick Nielsen was. I mean, that's a perfect example to play for someone so they could understand exactly how great of a band they were and how great the songs were.
So with Cheap Trick being from Rockford, Illinois, you'd think that they'd be more associated with Chicago, but instead they appear to have roots in Wisconsin and a lot of the rural Midwest, Iowa and rural Illinois. Why is that?
Well, that's how they were making a living for a couple of years there, was just playing that whole circuit of bars and clubs in Illinois and Wisconsin. And Ken Adamany was originally from Janesville, and he was always based in Madison. And he was booking shows ever since the late 50s when he had his own band. And all through the 60s, Ken Adamany, you know, at one point he had over 100 bands on his roster that he was booking shows for. So he had developed this entire circuit. And he could just keep the band working every night of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. They would play almost every night. And, you know, they were making a decent living. And, you know, they took their time before they really started trying to break in Chicago. They were more of a Madison or a Milwaukee band than a Chicago band. You know, that's where their following was. That's where they played a lot more than they ever really played in Chicago at the time.
One of the stories that I found really quite interesting was the story about the Cheap Trick logo, how that came into being.
Christopher Crow was such a great guy to talk to, because he's so articulate. He's a writer himself, and he was inspired to design that logo all on his own just because he loved the band so much. So they didn't even know he was doing it. And it's such an iconic, amazing logo that has contributed, I think, so much to their image and just the vibe, the mystique of the band. He ran it through multiple different processes, just overkill on purpose. When I talked to Paula Scher, who designed the first album cover, she kind of designed the album cover around the logo because she really loved what he was doing. She said it was a joke about reproduction. And when I talked to Chris about that, he was like, yeah, I guess that's right, but I didn't really think about it at the time. But it's kind of like Carrie Baker described it as a secretary typing it over and over right before a brutal suicide or something. It's like making the letters bleed. And he used these different processes to kind of distort it, but it was done manually. It was done physically, organically, and then just handed to the band at a club on just like a piece of cardstock.
So the band finally breaks and they go to Japan and they are received like the Beatles there. What is it that made them so popular in Japan?
Well, I think it's definitely the music. You know, the Japanese loved hard rock and glam rock at the time. So Cheap Trick was kind of the best of both worlds in that sense. And also just the image of the band, they were kind of cartoonish. I think the Japanese loved that. They have the funny guys and they have the heartthrobs. I mean, you know, so they just can appeal on multiple levels in multiple ways. It doesn't seem surprising that the Japanese in the 70s really got on board with Cheap Trick.
Live album, Cheap Trick at Budokan, became a huge hit for the band, but the story goes that they never really wanted to release it.
You know, it was recorded originally because they were so popular in Japan, so the label just wanted to put it out in Japan, you know, not really expecting that it would sell in America. And so the band didn't really pay a lot of attention to it. I know they didn't like the cover. The idea was it might be a double album. Then it was reduced to a single album. I think the band they weren't huge on the idea of a live album at the time, but they were willing to just have this thing for the fans in Japan. But then when it started really selling as an import, the label kind of picked up on that and wanted to put it out. And it's not like the band tried to stop them or anything, but it wasn't the band's idea. And I don't think it was really the direction the band envisioned going at the time, but obviously it ended up being a huge blessing in disguise.
I ran across some music on YouTube, and this isn't really covered in your book, but in 1980, Rick and Bunny, along with bassist Tony Levin, recorded a version of I'm Losing You for John Lennon's Double Fantasy album. And I don't know if you've heard it, but the version is absolutely fantastic, but it wasn't used on the record.
Here in some stranger's room, late in the afternoon, what am I doing here at all? Oh, ain't no doubt about it, I'm losing you.
How did that session come about, if you know, and why didn't that version make it on the album?
Yeah, it is great, and I have no idea why it didn't make it on the album. I mean, Jack Douglas was producing that, so that's how it came about. He mentioned it to John and then invited Rick and Bunny to come to a session. Rick talks about how that was the night he was playing for John Lennon was the night that Dax Nielsen was born. So he missed Dax's birth to play with John Lennon.
How do you think Cheap Trick is going to be remembered in rock and roll history?
You know, it was amazing to see them get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm so glad that they got that recognition. And that just comes from all their peers who love them. I mean, that's the thing is they've always been the band's band. I mean, almost every guy in every band from the 80s and the 90s loved Cheap Trick. All the hair metal guys and all the grunge guys and everybody in between. For all of those guys, you know, they are one of the quintessential bands. That's probably the most important thing is they have such great respect from their peers and from the critics and from the big rock fans.
Well, Brian Cramp, thanks a lot for spending some time with me today. Your book is, I'm going to call it, The Definitive History of Cheap Trick. This band has no past. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Steve.
Brian J. Cramp is the author of This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick. Steve Gotcher talked to him. Find out more about Cheap Trick at WPR.org/beta.
He says, well, you know, I see four Jews here, and I think we need a black person because of all the scenes with this, black sheriff.
Coming up, Patrick McGilligan joins us to talk about Mel Brooks' 1974 Western comedy, Blazing Saddles. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
That's Frankenstein.
Is anybody got a dime?
Der Schwartz.
I am Frau Blücher.
I'm not going into the toilet. I'm going into show business.
You little zipper neck.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Bialystok in bloom. Bialystok in bloom.
Now listen to me very carefully. Don't put the candle back.
Well, that suitably Brooksian audio logo means it's time for the third and final installment of our Mel Brooks docuseries. Actually, it's more of a docuseriesette. Today's installment is about Mel's Western satire, Blazing Saddles. Milwaukee biographer and film historian Patrick McGilligan joins us. He's the author of the definitive Mel Brooks biography, Funny Man, Mel Brooks. The passage about Blazing Saddles unveils a lot of the sliding doors behind the iconic comedy. Patrick joins us to talk about how the movie has aged, how it holds up, and how the idea actually came from a Madisonian.
The Madison connection to Blazing Saddles is very important because yes. Andrew Bergman, who was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, conceived the idea while he was in Madison of writing a black Western called Tex X, as in Malcolm X, and it would start, he had this idea of, you know, this black sheriff coming to town on a stallion, coming down Main Street, a frontier town, and it's a racist, it's a white racist frontier town, mm-hmm. and it was going to be a comedy.
By the power vested in me, by the Honorable William J. LaPetitMain, I hereby assume the duties of the office of sheriff in and for the township of Rockridge.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, let us not allow anger to rule the day. As your spiritual leader, I implore you to pay heed to this good book and what it has to say. Son, you're on your own.
And he went back to New York. And while he was a publicist, he wrote this novel. And the novel was good enough that it was optioned, and Bergman wrote a draft of a script, and it was really, at one point, scheduled to be filmed. And then Warner Brothers dropped it, at which point Mel Brooks enters the story. Now, he's kind of down on his luck from his own point of view, because neither the producers nor 12 Chairs have made him rich. And he runs into his agent, and his agent takes him out to lunch and then into his office and says, you know, the script came across and it's really good, but it really needs your crazy touch. And would you? And Mel always says when this kind of conversation takes place, well, I only do my own stuff, you know. But of course, as the book shows, he's doing other people's stuff over and over again throughout yes. his career. And that's yeah. one of the ways in which he's been very fortunate and also very shrewd by picking up on other people's ideas. So he reads the script. He calls Andrew Bergman. He says, I love it. Would you work on this with me? Which is his first shrewd move. And Andrew Bergman says, absolutely. You know, he adores Mel. He knows about him all the way back to your show of shows. And so Mel flies off to Acapulco, where he's doing a television special. He meets a guy there named Norman Steinberg, who he had met much earlier in time. And he said, I have this script back in New York. Do you want to like work on it with me? And Norman said, well, I have this writing partner and he's a dentist and, you know, in his, when he's not, you know, working as a writer and, you know, Mel raises an eyebrow, go, oh, a dentist and a lawyer. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. So, you know, and he gets these three guys together in a room, which by the way, enormously talented three guys. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, you know, I see four Jews here and I think we need a black person because of all the scenes with this, you know, black sheriff.
And the rest is history. Impressed? Always like to keep my audience riveted.
And so they kick around a few names, and Norman claims that, you know, he thought of Richard Pryor, and Mel claims that he thought of Richard Pryor. You know, Mel talks to Richard, and Mel says, we can't use the N-word, can we? And Richard said, you can't, but the bad guys could. And the N-word was sprinkled throughout the novel, you know, Andrew Bergman's original script, and that was part of the joke of the story, as it is an important part of the joke of the film. So they bring Richard Pryor in, and he doesn't last too long because he's drinking and doing coke. Mm. But he lasts long enough to really, really put his imprint on the film. And I think to make that part of the film, the racial commentary and the black character, Black Bart is his name, very, very important, partly because it was always thought that Richard Pryor would probably play it.
Why didn't Richard Pryor end up playing the part of Black Bart?
Well, it's a bit murky as to why Richard Pryor did not end up playing Black Bart. I think there was a sincere wish that he would. And Mel always said that Warner Brothers vetoed him because they were afraid that he wouldn't show up and that they wanted a bigger box office name. Because as I said, Pryor wasn't really established as a film personality at this point in time. It turned out to be serendipity because Anne Bancroft, who was very important to the early casting of Mel's, you know, first films, she reminded him of Cleavon Little, this actor who was not particularly well known. And I think Cleavon Little is just spectacular in the film. And he was cast, again, not at the 11th hour, but, you know, at the 10th hour, as a substitute for Richard Pryor. And that was serendipity, just as Gene Wilder was not going to be playing the Waco kid. Mel wanted an old Hollywood name in that part, and they looked at various people, including John Carradine and some other like old-time Western actor, and they finally got Gig Young, who's not really a Western actor, but he was a established name.
Yes.
They got him to play the part. He was a recovering alcoholic or an alcoholic, depending on your who you believe. And on the first day of filming, you know, went into a kind of post-alcoholic fit and had to be rushed by ambulance to the hospital. And Mel ran to a phone booth back in those good old days when there were phone booths outside the soundstage and phoned Gene Wilder, who was getting ready to go overseas to film The Little Prince with another director in London, and said, please come out here and save me and be in this movie. And Gene Wilder, they did have a good friendship, you know, got on a plane, got out, and over a weekend, you know, picked out a horse, picked out a costume, and, you know, that Monday morning, you know, played that scene where he wakes up in the jail cell upside down and said, you know, are we black?
Drunk and number two must be awake.
Are we awake?
We are not sure. Are we black?
Yes, we are.
Then we're awake. But we're very puzzled. I think I'd better straighten myself out.
Need any help?
Oh, all I can get.
It seems improbable, if not impossible, that Gig Young would be good at all in that part. And Gene Wilder being Richard Pryor's age, being a touch daffy, you know, like Richard Pryor, and playing off Cleavon Little's smoothness, you know, was really, really just a brilliant, you know, final stroke of casting. Completely accidental.
Yes, for sure. We can't really talk about Blazing Saddles without talking about the famous campfire scene.
Gee, how about some more beans, Mr. Taggart?
I'd say you've had enough.
Who came up with that idea?
Well, I can't pin it down, even though I talked to all the survivors in the room who are working on the script, and every one of them says they might have thought of it or Mel might have thought of it. It's the kind of thing they would have thought of, because they describe those sessions as very, very free, give and take, free-for-alls, you know, with a lot of crazy ideas and everybody saying, oh, no, that's not funny, or, oh, that's really, really funny. And, you know, the thing that made people laugh the most is what they decided to do. So somebody came up with it, but whoever came up with it, Mel said, I love it. And usually when Mel loves something later on, it becomes something that he thought of, you know, in his reminiscences. And then, you know, on the set, all the actors liked, including these, you know, old-time actors like Slim Pickens, you know, who, you know, recently converted to comedy in Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, but otherwise really wasn't known for comedy. And, you know, they did this very elaborate, you know, shooting of that scene on the set where Mel would say, now lift one side of your buttock, now lift the other side of your buttock. And he prided himself on, you know, he was going to put all the fart noises in post-production, because he loved post-production, and he loved putting noises in post-production, including, you know, noises out of his own mouth. And so he and all the sound people had great fun, you know, flapping their arms with making fart noises and making, and it's one of his specialties, rubber faces and crazy noises coming out of his mouth. And it really now seems passé. And yet, the way it's staged and how it happens is still very, very funny. It's not dated at all.
How did the audiences, the public, respond to Blazing Saddles and the idea of a black sheriff and the use of the frequent use of the N-word?
The N-word was used frequently in Richard Pryor's act. It was used in many, many other films being made at the time. It was used by Black Power militants. So when Andrew Bergman thought of it, it was pervasive in the culture, and it wasn't always used for comedy, but it was used for comedy in some circumstances. So this might be, you know, by the time Blazing Saddles is released, this might be the end of that cultural curve, meaning this might be the last time you could do it.
Yes.
And it certainly is done pervasively in the film. It certainly is done with Richard Pryor's help, very, very intelligently, shrewdly, critically, interestingly, hilariously. And it wasn't commented on negatively in reviews at all. I mean, Mel gives interviews nowadays where he says, you know, we couldn't make that kind of film nowadays because it's politically incorrect. I'm not sure, because it's so well done, it got away with it, as it was being gotten away with in the culture at large when it was really well done. I mean, people really, really get the point. It's an anti-racist point, as Richard Pryor pointed out in his initial conversations with Mel, i.e. the bad guys can say it, but the good guys shouldn't say it. So it gives the film a level, a strange level of seriousness that it's really not very serious about, meaning it's not a filmmaking giving political messages. But that serious aspect of the film remains, you know, that Black Bart, even though he's a complete cartoon character and a fictional creation, so much so that we see at the end of the film that he's being played by an actor, that Black Bart is facing prejudice in the white frontier town where everybody is named Johnson, and there's one flavor of Howard and Johnson's ice cream because it's early in time. And all these jokes about white frontier town that I consider to be pretty subversive, even though most people take them on the chin nowadays and don't necessarily see their subversiveness. To be honest, most people, like when I show the film to my class at Marquette, people laugh. But afterwards I ask them, oh, why is the Howard Johnson's joke funny? Well, they don't know.
No, of course not.
So I give them a whole list of questions. Who is Madeline Kahn burlesquing in the film? They don't know.
No.
Their guesses are kind of funny, but they have no idea. And it's kind of like what Woody Allen said about Mel Brooks when someone asked him if he liked Mel Brooks's comedy. He said, well, I don't like them all, but you know, what I really like is he gets so much joy out of his comedy. You know, there's a joy in his comedy that Allen never got out of his own comedies. And they had been acquaintances and worked together on Sid Caesar television shows back in the late 1950s, so they knew each other. And I think that spirit, that sort of merry, subversive, you know, noisy spirit of Blazing Saddles lives on. It's very, very strong. And so people laugh often when they don't get the jokes, but I think they get the Black Bart joke.
Yeah, very well said. Patrick McGilligan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of Funny Man, Mel Brooks. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Jenna Friedman, Brian J. Cramp, and Patrick McGilligan. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRbeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
Special thanks to producer Tyler Ditter.
Like I told you, once you establish yourself, they got to accept you.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
My mind is a raging torrent, flooded with rivulets of thought cascading into a waterfall of creative alternatives.